It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. You could summarize the U.S. economy right now in two short sentences. It's a good time to own stocks. It's a bad time to look for a job.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed above 10,000 yesterday, first time that's happened in about a year. Yet even as the Dow exceeds 10,000, the unemployment rate is heading toward 10%. You get a clue to what's behind both those trends when you follow the story of big banks. We're going to talk about those institutions at the heart of our economy with David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal, regular guest here. David, good morning.
Good morning, Steve and Renee.
One reason we called you is that J.P. Morgan reported profits yesterday of $3.6 billion in a single quarter. Does that suggest to you that the banks are doing better?
Well, certainly that big bank is doing better. It's interesting, though, that they didn't make their money the old-fashioned way, lending it to people and getting paid back. Their consumer businesses actually were awful, and they said they had to write off some loans. They made most of their money investment banking and trading, the business of serving companies and buying and selling securities on the markets.
Does that basically mean that they're finding creative ways to make money, but not necessarily doing the kind of economic activity that grows businesses and creates jobs?
Well, some of the stuff they're doing in investment banking does help grow businesses. They get paid a fee for helping companies do deals and sell bonds and stuff like that. But not very much of it is coming from lending to ordinary people or small businesses. To that extent, you're right.
So was this the government plan here for banks to be profitable, stocks to be rising, but for the unemployment rate to be very high?
I don't think that was the long-run plan. But as you know, the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, has said, I didn't want to save Wall Street. I wanted to save Main Street. But in order to do that, I had to save Wall Street first. I think we have a little clip of him.
We've been reading some quotes from past months from Ben Bernanke. He said, I care about Wall Street for one reason and one reason only, because what happens on Wall Street matters to Main Street. And he goes on to say, if we don't take the steps necessary to make sure that credit is flowing again, then my father couldn't get a loan to build his new store. It sounds, David Wessel, like his father still couldn't get the loan to build his new store, even though J.P. Morgan has a big profit.
That's right. Basically, he's done the first half of his equation. He saved Wall Street, but it hasn't flowed through to Main Street yet.
So does that mean that the financial bailout that was passed by Congress and signed by President Bush late last year worked or not?
Well, I think it worked to the extent that its goal was to prevent the implosion of the financial system, to prevent us from reading today that J.P. Morgan was about to become a government-owned company rather than a successful big private bank. The Treasury had $700 billion. They spent about $445 billion of it. They got $70 back. The big banks, anyways, are doing better. But the plan is that they will eventually begin to lend and the economy will get going again. And that part of the plan hasn't yet come to fruition.
And what about small banks, which are a big deal, of course, when you get away from the coasts especially?
Well, a lot of small banks are having a hard time now because, unlike J.P. Morgan, they invested in commercial real estate, office buildings, hotels, and malls, and a lot of those are empty and going under. And so we're seeing this huge wave of commercial real estate failures that's affecting the small banks, and that's particularly hard for people or businesses that rely on an individual bank that's now closed. And so we expect a lot more failures of small banks, even though the government has spent some of that TARP money to try and prop some of them up.
Well, given everything you've said very briefly, what's the likely political reaction as people learn that Wall Street compensation, according to your newspaper, David, is going to exceed what it was in 2007 before the crash?
My guess is that people and members of Congress are going to be pretty angry. They think Wall Street is doing well with taxpayer help and workers aren't.
David Wessel of the Wall Street Journal, always good to talk with you.
A pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and today was a big day on Wall Street. The Dow closed above the 10,000 mark for the first time in a year. Better-than-expected retail sales numbers drove those gains. So did surprisingly strong earnings reports from Intel and from J.P. Morgan Chase. Joining us now to talk about all this is NPR's Jim Ciroli. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Michelle.
The Dow and the other market indexes are still far below their peaks, but they've managed a pretty good comeback in the last 6 months. How'd they do this?
Yeah, we've seen, just a kind of steady return of confidence, both in the stock market and in the economy as a whole. I mean, you remember probably during the worst days of the banking crisis last winter, nobody wanted to invest in anything. I mean, people put their money in mattresses, so to speak. The Dow fell all the way to 6547 on March 9th. I think since then there's just been this kind of slow accumulation of evidence that, you know, the economy's picking up steam, little things here and there. Today, retail sales, we got a report that retail sales were up for the second straight month when you left autos out. So there's been a lot of things like that, and now we've climbed back to 10,000. You know, it's a meaningless number in terms of the market, but it gets headlines. People see it, and so it will probably be good for consumer confidence, and of course that's good for the economy as a whole.
So despite the evidence of this uptick, we're still technically in a recession, and unemployment is still very, very high. How can investors be so confident about stocks right now?
Well, that is a question that a lot of people are asking. You know, there's no shortage of market bears right now who say the economy's fragile, unemployment is 9.8%, and it's probably climbing. You know, we could see a double-dip recession. You know, people say companies aren't so much making money as they are cutting workers and using their plants less. So that makes their profits rise, but it's artificial. People have been saying all that, but it hasn't stopped the rally. Of course, you know, the stock market is all about anticipating where the economy is going. A lot of investors see all these good things happening, these good reports, and they see light at the end of the tunnel, and that is what sends the markets higher.
Jim, before I let you go, I want to ask you about the banking sector, because the banking sector was very much at the heart of the economic crisis. How much have bank stocks recovered?
Well, they have rebounded a lot. Remember, just a few months ago, people were talking about nationalizing banks. They took huge hits from the subprime mortgage crisis. They saw big losses in retail activity from the recession. You know, Citigroup was selling for $1 a share at one time. But we've seen the dust settle. There are some survivors out there like Goldman Sachs, like Wells Fargo, and they're in a really good position to take advantage of the opportunities as the economy recovers. So they're helping companies restructure. They're doing a lot of trading. And you had J.P. Morgan Chase today saying it made a lot of money in the third quarter. But still you have this boulder in the road, and that is consumer loans. Banks have had to set aside a lot of money to cover potential losses, and that's going to be an issue as long as unemployment is high.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
That was NPR's Jim Zaroli in New York.
Ted Friend is a staff writer for The New Yorker, but by birth, Friend is also the uneasy member of another kind of elite club. He's a purebred WASP. Friend's new memoir, Cheerful Money, reflects on his WASP heritage. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
F. Scott Fitzgerald was, of course, right. The rich are different from you and me, and not just because, as Hemingway said in his famous slapdown of that remark, they have more money. For me, the difference was clarified many years ago by a cocktail appetizer. I was teaching at a college on Philadelphia's WASPy main line, and one evening I was summoned to a cocktail reception for the college's visiting trustees. At least the food and drinks will be good, I thought. I was half right. The top-shelf liquor flowed freely, but the only food I remember was an appetizer consisting of a limp, glistening bacon strip wrapped around a chestnut and secured with a toothpick. What was this? On the rare occasions that my blue-collar family entertained, my mother anxiously served appetizers of celery stalks and saltines topped with American cheese slices. At least they were edible. But the difference was the manner in which these grotesque bacon chestnut pellets were offered, as though all of us at the reception were above food and other pedestrian bodily necessities. As though, if need be, we could live for decades, stoked only by clever remarks and gin fumes. Like Fitzgerald, Tad Friend finds the ways of the rich, specifically the WASP rich, to be infinitely mysterious and romantic. Friend has a leg up on Fitzgerald, however, because he was born one of them, a purebred son of old money. Someone whose birthright gave him entree to elite schools and summers at the family cottages in the Hamptons and Vermont, where in one, the mouse holes in a mattress were stuffed with back issues of Country Life magazine. Fortunately for literature, if not for Friend personally, the piles of cash and cachet accumulated by his robber baron forefathers have largely evaporated, just as WASPs themselves have waned in power as the ruling class in this country. Friend's memoir, called Cheerful Money, is a droll, psychologically astute, and sometimes nostalgic look backward at the WASP world that was. Friend does much more here than just crack exquisite Bertie Woosterish jokes at the expense of his bloodlines. He takes readers on an anthropological journey deep into the consciousness of a class, and in so doing, mulls over the question of whether all those motley ancestral genes have mattered more than he would like to think in shaping his life and identity. At the beginning of his memoir, Tad Friend supplies an extended family tree full of androgynously named relatives that allows him to structure his story in chapter-length visits, backwards and forwards, among members of the clan. Friend's father, Dory, served for a time as president of Swarthmore College. Friend describes him as sporting an Easter Island-sized head stuffed with knowledge. His mother, Elizabeth, known as Lib, came in second to Sylvia Plath in a poetry contest at Smith, judged by W.H. Auden. In retelling the story of that near miss, she would demonstrate the brittle brio for which WASPs are noted by saying, "Just as well I didn't win, head in the oven," and so forth. Throughout the memoir, Friend points to himself and his family to bolster the many crisp generalizations he makes about WASPs. For instance, in mulling over his early writing career and the WASP aversion to surrendering oneself completely, Friend says, "I felt uncomfortable thinking of myself as a writer or an artist. Serious art, rife with feeling and conflict, is not encouraged among WASPs. Andrew Wyeth's painting Christina's World is about as near as we care to get to the abyss." But it's the WASP trait that Friend identifies as most defining, that is, his feelings of disconnection from his parents and his subsequent disconnection from the many women he dates, that compel him to spend all his lovely trust fund money in psychotherapy. As befits a WASP to the manner born, Friend tells his personal and familial tale without self-pity, recognizing that it's his inherited duty to entertain and amuse his audience, even as he's occasionally serving up gristly confessions and nut-hard kernels of emotional truth.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Cheerful Money, Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor by Tad Friend. Singer Al Martino, who was born in Philadelphia and was a friend of Mario Lanza, died yesterday of a heart attack at the age of 82. His most popular records included Volare, Caramia, and Here in My Heart. But to many people, he was best known for playing the part of the Vegas entertainer Johnny Fontaine in The Godfather. We'll close with his performance in the film. I'm Terry Gross.
Vicino ma facima ancora cuore per trespassare.
The national debate over health care is contentious in part because it's seen as a risk. Congress is tinkering with a huge part of the economy, and it's hard to be sure what works.
Lawmakers do have some past experience to call on. There's the experience of states, and there's the experience of individuals. This morning, we'll hear from one of each.
We begin with the state of North Carolina. That state made a change to its version of Medicaid, the health program for the poor. Doctors like it, patients stay healthier, and the state saved hundreds of millions of dollars. Rose Hoban reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
Every day is busy for Nurse Juanita Larkins.
Good afternoon. This is Juanita. How can I help you?
She's one of three nurses who manage Medicaid patients at Goldsboro Pediatrics. Goldsboro is a growing town surrounded by old tobacco fields that are being converted to suburbs. About 15,000 Medicaid-eligible children come to the clinic.
All of them are not known to us. I mean, but those that are introduced to us by whatever means, we will attempt to help them if we can.
One family Larkins does know well is Brigida Archie and her five children, who qualify for Medicaid.
Come on, Boone.
Archie stays home with the kids while her husband attends community college. She and four of the five children have asthma. The fifth has a genetic disorder. Archie says she couldn't have handled her kids' health care without help.
I learned the proper way to do exercise for people with asthma. I learned how to take control of it, not let it control me. One way is to watch the stuff that we eat as far as what can cause your asthma, what can cause your symptoms.
Archie can't remember the last time any of her kids went to the emergency room. Care manager Juanita Larkins works hard to make that possible, visiting the Archie home, joining them during appointments, and giving advice over the phone.
Mom knows if he's having an exacerbation, she will call, and if she can't get through up there to make an appointment, she knows to call us, and we will get her in.
Goldsboro Pediatrics does not pay Larkin's salary. It's covered by Community Care of North Carolina, the state's Medicaid program. Joe Ponzi is a doctor at Goldsboro Pediatrics.
We need these people who can help us to make sure that we can dot all the dots and cross all the T's and get people to come in if they need additional help, get them resources if they need those resources, and make sure that they are consistently following evidence-based care.
The program covers all of North Carolina's 950,000 Medicaid patients, and community care has garnered national attention. Vermont used the model to restructure its health care delivery, and Ponzi says it works because care managers like Larkins save Medicaid money.
You know, one hospital ER visit, is it $1,200, $1,000? You know, it's just unbelievable. One admission, $10,000 to $15,000. So you save two or three hospital admissions for asthma, you've paid for a salary.
Some say doctors should do case management, but it takes a lot of time and they don't get reimbursed for it. So it makes sense for Medicaid to pay for the state's 400-plus care managers. After all, that's who pays when patients land in the hospital. For community care to work, doctors have to buy into the model, says Alan Dobson. He's a primary care doctor who was the state Medicaid director. Dobson says he knows doctors don't want bureaucrats to tell them what to do. Instead, physician panels decide what constitutes quality, and they monitor how well their peers are doing.
And so when you go to physicians and say, we would like to improve the quality, we would like to provide you with help in taking care of some of the most difficult patients when you're talking about Medicaid, the poorest and the sickest that we have in North Carolina, they usually embrace it with open arms.
An independent financial analysis shows the program saves North Carolina Medicaid up to $170 million a year. And people are noticing. Dobson had to interrupt his summer vacation when the White House called to ask about community care. For NPR News, I'm Rose Hoban in Durham, North Carolina.
Round two of Major League Baseball's postseason begins tonight with the Los Angeles Dodgers hosting the Philadelphia Phillies in a rematch of last year's National League Championship Series. The Los Angeles Angels and New York Yankees start the American League Championship Series in New York tomorrow night. Both series are best of seven. And commentator John Feinstein joins us now to discuss them. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Renee.
So the Phillies are the defending World Series champions. The Dodgers had the National League's best record this season. What does that tell us about this series?
Well, I think if it tells us anything, it's that this series will be closer than last year's when the Phillies beat the Dodgers fairly easily in five games. The Dodgers surprised a lot of people, myself included, by sweeping the St. Louis Cardinals, who appeared to have the best pitching in baseball in the opening round in the division series. They have outstanding pitching, but the key to this whole series may be two Phillies pitchers. Even though the Phillies have great hitters in Ryan Howard and Chase Utley in the middle of their lineup, Cole Hamels was the MVP of postseason last year. He's been injured throughout this season, pitched poorly in the division series last week. He's the game one starter for the Phillies. How he goes may determine how the Phillies go, along with their closer, Brad Lidge, the guy who pitches the ninth inning. Again, last year he was perfect, 47 for 47 in ninth innings. This year he blew 11 saves. The two of them could decide which way this series goes.
And, John, back to those Cardinals' loss, what do you think happened?
I think that two things happened. One, that Matt Holliday, their outfielder, just lost a ball in the lights in game two that would have won the second game. It would have been the third out in the ninth inning, and the series would have been 1-1 and psychologically entirely different if it goes back to St. Louis 1-1. But I also think that the Dodgers were able to get to the top two Cardinal pitchers, and that surprised the Cardinals and changed the series psychologically.
Okay, so on to Yankees Angels. Based on their regular season, are the Yankees a really heavy favorite?
No, they're not. And the reason they're not is because of past postseasons. The Angels have beaten the Yankees in postseason three times since 2002. And that is going to be a factor. The Angels believe they can beat the Yankees in spite of the Yankees' overwhelming statistics and their 103 wins, as you mentioned, in the regular season. And in Anaheim in particular, the Yankees struggle. So I think, again, like the National League, this will be a very close series.
Well, let's look to the past and other matchups in years past. These are different teams from when they last met in postseason. What does the past say to us?
Well, they wear the same uniforms, and that matters, even though you're right. There are a lot of different players. I think when it comes into play, Renee, is in a close series. The Angels had the same sort of hex against the Red Sox. They had lost series after series to them in postseason going back to 1986. But they were able to sweep the Red Sox in three games. If that series had been close, had gone five games, then I think the pass comes into play. Same with this. If it goes seven games, the Yankee fans in Yankee Stadium that night will be very nervous about the past.
And Alex Rodriguez, do you think he finally broke out of his postseason funk in the Minnesota series?
I will give you a definite maybe on that. He played very well. He had a key home run in game two. He drove in six runs. But he's not going to exercise those ghosts until he wins a World Series in a Yankees uniform, until he performs deeper into the playoffs in the first round. He's had other good first rounds before. Then came the infamous collapse in 2004 against the Red Sox. He needs to have a big series against the Angels to get people to say that he's not non-Mr. October, which is what he's been until now.
All right, John Feinstein, whose new book is Change Up, Mystery at the World Series. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Renee.